Isn't that the story of our lives? All my life, you've been faithful. All my life, you've been so, so good. That's the perspective if you look back with 20/20 hindsight and go, man, God, you're amazing. And so it's great to be able to worship him together and to come together today as we look to his word to see what lessons he might have for us today. We are now in Joshua chapter 9, so you can turn over there if you'd like. The children of Israel have, as you know, if you've been with us, escaped 400 years of slavery in Egypt, miraculously, went to the wilderness, received the law, spent 40 years wandering around. Now they finally, under the leadership of Joshua, they've gone into the land that God had promised to them. And now it's time to take it. They got word from Rahab that everybody's scared of you guys. And that encouraged them, but then their first battle, they didn't even have to, all they had to do was march around and honk horns and yell, and they won this battle, which should have intimidated everyone. They had a speed bump. Somebody kept a few souvenirs, and they had to take care of that. But then, as you saw last week, the city of Ai, they used great strategy with God's leading them and helping them, and they conquered Ai, and now they're on a roll. And you think, the momentum is building for the fulfillment of everything that God had promised, going all the way back to Abraham. There's a piece of land in this world that's going to be yours, and I'm going to give it to you. And now we're on the road. We've taken the first couple of chunks of it, and now momentum is building. But then in chapter 9, something kind of weird happens. I mean, it's understandable that all of these Canaanite kings want to gather together and have a battle. You know, they're like, they're coming for us. We need to stick together, which is not a bad battle strategy when it comes down to it. Now, remember when it talks about kings, when it talks about these like nations, they're just podunk towns. You know, it's like they think of themselves as a big nation, as, you know, they have a king. He's like the mayor of Aliso Viejo probably has as many people underneath him as most of these kings. But they see the handwriting on the wall. We're in trouble. Israel's coming. What are we going to do? And so it says in verse 1, Joshua chapter 9, all the kings who were on this side of the Jordan, that is, if you're thinking of Israel, it's primarily the land that he promised, although they had some land on the east side of the Jordan River for 2.5 tribes, that they were going to take that. But ultimately, the land was the land on the west side of the Jordan River. It goes from the Jordan River all the way to the Mediterranean coast. On the north, it goes all the way up to where Lebanon is. On the south, it goes down to Egypt. So if you think of Israel as California, because most of you are probably more familiar with the California map than an Israeli or Middle Eastern map, it's kind of like Jerusalem's down in the south, central part of Israel, kind of like where San Bernardino is. So they didn't sell meth there, but other than that, it's like located there. So then, but then you have the whole Pacific Ocean coast would be the Mediterranean Sea. Mexico would be Egypt, and, you know, Oregon would, in that case, be Lebanon. But you have this whole section, God said, this is going to be yours. So all of these kings are like, they had heard about, you know, the Jews escaping Egypt miraculously. They had heard about the battles that they had won over on the east side in the wilderness. Now they hear about Jericho, and then they hear about Ai, and they're like, this is it. Backs to the wall, we better do something. And so they all got together from the Great Sea, Mediterranean, toward Lebanon in the north, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, or I call them Hivites. People sometimes call them Hivites. And the Jebusites, heard about it, that they gathered together to fight with Joshua and Israel with one accord. So they're all ready, they're unified, they're like, this is our last stand. Not a bad battle strategy in a way. Let's take the battle to them. This is our home turf, if you will. So, you know, as that's laid out, then you have this funny story, beginning with verse 3. When the inhabitants of Gibeon, which Gibeon was a large city among the Hivite tribe, they heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai. And of course, they heard about it partly because all these kings were trying to rally everyone together, including them. But they started thinking about it, and they came up with a clever plan. They worked craftily in verse 4 and went and pretended to be ambassadors. And they took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins, torn and mended. They wore old, worn-out, you know, clothes, and they had bread that they had let get moldy and rotten. And they go to Joshua in verse 6, there in Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country." We would tell you where it is, but it's like so far away you've never... We're from a place you've never heard of. Smart. "Now, therefore, make a covenant with us." Now, right away, you think, if this is legit, why would someone who's from so far away that you've never even heard of, why would they need to come to make a covenant with you? Everyone who knows anything about the children of Israel knows they have a specific piece of land that God has promised to them from Abraham on forward. Now, why do you, it's like if we're having a local fight between, you know, California and Oregon, say, why do we need to make a covenant? Why would Illinois need to come and go, "Now, we want to make sure"? It's like, we don't care about Illinois. Who in the world would ever want to be there? You know, but they didn't, nobody questions it. It's like, yeah, we're from, oh, a long ways away. You would have never heard of us. So right away, offering a treaty, who gains from this? No one. If you're truly from far away, you have no reason to do this. And if they are truly from far away, why do you need to make a deal with them? You could just go, you know what, don't worry. You don't need to make a deal with us. But they came and conned them, basically. And so the men of Israel, in verse 7, said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you dwell among us." They were at least suspicious. "How can we make a covenant with you?" They're like, what if you're somebody, what if you're lying about where you're from? So they're not completely stupid, just sort of. And so they said to Joshua, "Oh no, we are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" And they said to him, "I don't have a map, but from a very far country your servants have come because of the name of Yahweh, the Lord, your God, for we have heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt." They're like, we're responding to your altar call. We want to be with you. We want to be a part of you. They played the spiritual card, and, you know, apparently that helped. And all that everything he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were there on the east side of the Jordan River. And therefore, verse 11, "Our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions with you for the journey and go to meet them and tell them, we are your servants. Now, therefore, make a covenant with us.'" If you're from so far away, why do you even want to be our servants? So Joshua was suspicious, but not quite enough. They go, look at our bread. It's all moldy. Look at our wineskins. They used to be filled with new, fresh wine. Now they're like, you know, just filled with corrupt crud. Our clothes are all old. You think we'd wear clothes like this? But verse 14, here's the key concept. "Then the men of Israel took some of these provisions that they had, but they did not ask counsel of the Lord." What a weird thing. They're grilling them. They're checking out their stuff. They're even, and yet they fell for like a stupid story that makes no sense. And not once did they think, you know, in the past we've got into some trouble when we didn't pray. Maybe we ought to pray. But it's like, no, I think I'm feeling like we can handle this. This is a no-brainer. You know, almost every dumb thing you'll ever do in your life seems like a no-brainer at the time. And that's the way it was for them. They didn't seek counsel from the Lord. And so Joshua signed a peace treaty with them. Verse 15, made a covenant with them that they would live. Rulers of the congregation swore to them. In verse 16, 3 days later, they figured out, wait a minute, these guys, these are Gibeonites. They're from, and to give you a perspective on where their city, where Gibeon is, if you think of the map of, you know, California with San Bernardino being Jerusalem, this is just north of there a little bit, between there and present-day Ramallah. It's in the West Bank area that now is populated mostly by Arabs, but like they were from right there. And once they figured it out, you'd think, oh, what are we going to do? But verse 17 says, but the children of Israel journeyed, came to their cities on the third day, and there were those cities, but the children of Israel did not attack them because the rulers, the congregation, had sworn to them by Yahweh, God of Israel, and all the congregation complained against the rulers. The leaders didn't have the sense to pray, but they at least had a sense of, I am going to keep my word. I made this deal, and I'm going to keep it, because they knew God didn't want them going back on their word, which is really a key concept, and it's something that's such a rare concept nowadays. Now we just think, oh, we can get out of that. We'll find some excuse, some way to back out of it. But they go, we swore before God that we would keep, that we would not do war with the Gibeonites, and we need to keep our word. And even though the popular opinion was, they lied to us, let's kill them. Then, verse 19, all the rulers said to all the congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord Yahweh, God of Israel. Now, therefore, we may not touch them. But they said, you can do this. We will let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swore. The rulers said to them, let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for all the congregation, as the rulers had promised them. There was a clause in the contract that said, you won't kill us, but we will be your servants. So they're like, we do need people who are clever. These guys are definitely clever, and they can do some woodwork and handle some of the chores around the tabernacle, which is really funny that you would take people who are not from the children of Israel, and you would give them a job that we would think would be really important. But that's how much they felt committed to what they had promised. We messed up. We didn't seek the Lord. But now we're going to let these guys become a part of the work of God. They said that they believed in Yahweh, the God of Israel. So we'll give them an opportunity to actually serve. Now, again, we in this day and age, we have a hard time with the whole concept of servitude and things like that. It was completely a part of their culture. And, you know, this was just kind of what they did. They said, okay, fine, this is the deal and you can do it. A lot of times people talk today about, you know, the borders and like, oh, God always told them to be kind to foreigners who are within their borders. That's true, but he also said make them slaves and circumcise them. That might cut down on immigration a little bit, but this is just what they did. So Joshua called for them, and he called them on the carpet. Why have you deceived us, in verse 22, saying we're very far from you when you're neighbors? Now, therefore, you are cursed, and none of you shall be freed from being slaves. woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God. And they answered Joshua and said, because your servants were clearly told that the Lord your God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore, we were very much afraid for our lives because of you, and we've done this thing. I know what we did was a bad thing, but you got to understand, it's life and death. We believed that God was going to do what he said he was going to do. And so the way we did that, you may argue with our methodology, but our heart was in a place of we care about our people and we're willing to serve your God. Now, therefore, here we are, verse 25. In your hands, do with us as it seems good and right to do to us. So he delivered them to the children of Israel, and they didn't kill them. Verse 27, that day Joshua made them woodcutters and water carriers for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord in the place which he would choose, even to this day. He's like, you guys outsmarted us, so now we're going to channel your smart abilities into creating crafts for God. You say you want to serve God, we're going to give you a special opportunity to do it. And they did. Now, when we look at this story, we can easily go, this is kind of weird, because it obviously would have never happened if they had sought the Lord. God wouldn't have said, yeah, go ahead. You know, make people believe, fall for the sucker line that they're giving you. Didn't do that. What they did was because of their, you know, decision to not follow God. And yet, somehow, it's more important for you to keep your word and have integrity than it is for you to think that you can make a sloppy decision and then go back and unmake it and undo it. You can't live in the past. You have to live in the present, moving forward to the future. So where are your commitments today? Keep those commitments, and that becomes God's will. Now, was this ultimately a good or a bad thing that they made this deal with the Gibeonites, these Hivites? Well, it's both, really. I mean, as a result, throughout their history, they had to continue as a people with some of these Gentiles right in their midst, with some people who were there who really it wasn't the original plan to include them, and yet they had to live with them, and sometimes it was, you know, it was a problem, but they honored their word, which is really a good thing. Now, hundreds of years later, Saul decided, you know what? That was a bad deal. Let's go kill the Gibeonites. And he killed a whole bunch of them. And God began to judge Israel, and they were losing wars right and left. And when David went to the Lord, he said, because of what Saul did to the Gibeonites, you go make things right with Gibeon before you come and ask me to help you do what I'm calling you to do. And so God held them to that agreement. Now, sadly, the Gibeonites were, you got to give them credit, they were clever. They said, okay, David went to him and said, what do you want? We'll do anything. And they go, give us seven of Saul's sons or descendants, grandsons, whatever, and we're going to kill them. And David's like, okay. He protected Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth, but he sent another Mephibosheth who was probably a grandson and six other guys, and the Gibeonites killed them. So this decision to not seek the Lord certainly had its cost. At the same time, God said, I care more about you keeping your word than I do about whatever the original plan and the original potential was. And to me, that's such an important lesson for us to remember all the time. We live in a culture where your word means nothing. People will promise you something, and then they'll find a loophole, they'll go back, they'll try to undo it. We spend so much more, and I thought it was ironic that this passage came up right after Valentine's Day, because let's be honest about Valentine's. Let's be honest about marriage. If you're married today, is because you were able to pull a Gibeonite scam on another person. You presented your best foot forward. You didn't like, oh, this is who I am. There may be some exceptions. I remember Randy Ziegler, who he was marrying a girl who's a lot younger than he was, and they went for premarital counseling, and Randy goes, look, this is who I am. I don't get any better than this. I'll probably get worse than this. And Lynn suckered for it and lasted for a while at least. But, you know, I remember for me, I started dating Ann. It wasn't like, I'm just going to totally be myself. I'm like, how can I avoid chasing her away? And so I even, like, at our first date, I got like a haircut, put on a little fake leather fancy coat, and for the first several weeks we were dating, I'm eating vegetables, because she was like going through this vegetarian hippie stage, and I'm like, I hate vegetables. As far as I'm concerned, the only vegetables God made are potatoes and corn. Yeah. But I had to do this. I had to act this way. Now, every once in a while, the real me would leak out, but she's like weighing it out. But she was doing the same thing for me. I know her after, you know, all these decades. I know things about her that I didn't know about her then. She didn't come with a, okay, look, let's get everything on the table. If you do that, if you're just totally, I'm just going to be myself. I know some people who are that way, by the way, all single. You won't make a deal unless there's a little bit of Gibeonite in you. Sorry. It's just the way it is. And then you hope that you end up finding out, but this is such a blessing. I am so thankful that we hung in there together as a couple and saw what God did in our lives, because what we knew then and what we know now are two different things. And we endured that process, but there were times when it's like, we have made a commitment to each other. I had no idea that you could be such a slob. I had no idea that you could be such a nag. I had no idea, but it's like, I promised. There's a contract for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, you know, to love and to cherish until death do us part. According to God's holy ordinance, I pledge that. That's my contract before God. And my life is better, so much better. Because there are times when you start thinking, I didn't know that. I didn't see that coming. That the contract, the commitment, the covenant actually kicks in and helps me to end up achieving blessings that I could have never experienced otherwise. So there's a little bit of Gibeonite in all of us, I think. By the way, commitments are commitments. Now, if you're here and you're like, oh man, I hate Valentine's Day because I'm single. I hate Valentine's Day because I'm divorced, whatever. You start where you are. I mean, I am not saying if your marriage failed, some marriages fail. I'm not trying to put a trip on you and tell you you need to go back to that person. It starts today. Here's your commitment. I think you should honor your divorce as much as you honor your marriage. It's like you keep your word because you can't sit there and undo the past. You have to keep moving forward, but does your word matter? Do your commitments matter, or don't they? So it's certainly true within the family unit. Yeah, there are plenty of times when you think having kids will be something that's totally different than it was, but you have the kids. You don't back off of that. And eventually, they give you grandkids, and then that's payday. But, you know, there are a lot of areas, I think, in school even. You know, now in school, you can take a college class, and you're allowed to drop the class the day before the final. Like, what? Like, completely undo that. I can wipe that away. And you look at college sports nowadays, where with NIL money and everything, there are guys who play football for six different colleges before they then go to the pros. Your word means nothing. Commitments don't matter. That's our society. That's the way things are heading. And it affects all kinds of areas of our lives. I mean, I think it affects work life as well. You know, sometimes people will, I'll just bounce from job to job to job to job. It used to be somebody got a job, they knew what they were going to do for a career, they worked it for their whole work life, they ended up getting a pension, and they retired, and that was the way it was. But nowadays, it's like people are changing constantly. I'm not saying you don't have a right to do it, but what it says is the commitment. Where is it? This week I was reading a book. A friend of mine, Dennis, who goes to church here, was an executive with IBM. And I'm reading, unless you're a complete nerd, you wouldn't really enjoy. I loved it, but because I am a nerd. But I'm reading his story where he's an executive with IBM. During the mainframe days and the system 3836s, with then the invention of the personal computers and laptops, and then all the clones and all the battles with them and fights with Microsoft. And he's like living this out on the front lines. But when he worked for Big Blue, for IBM, he was like, they put him in Europe, they put him in Florida, they put him in Texas, they put him in different divisions and different assignments. But as I'm reading his story, and even at the end, there was finally a place where, okay, this is over, and he went and helped a couple of other companies get going before he ultimately retired. But I'm thinking, this is so rare nowadays, where somebody says, I'm connected to this company, and I'm gonna serve this company. We just don't have a lot of those kinds of commitments. I think church is kind of the same way, frankly, where it's like, I go here today, but I'm not saying anything about tomorrow. For most of history, somebody was in a church, they stayed in that church. Things would change, things would go better, things would go worse. I mean, here, and I'm always amused, there's sometimes people who come here to check out the church, and they decide they can't even sit through my entire service. I'll say something offensive, which is not unusual at all, and then boom, I see somebody get up mad. It's like, wow, you're really committed. And then at the same time, I look at, there are people in our church who were at this church long before me, and they're just faithfully, this is their church. It's not, they're not following a person, they're a part of a church. That's the way it used to be historically. You know, today it's more like we're all consumers. We're a little of this, a little of that, a little of the other thing. The fact is, there's something secure in making a commitment and sticking with it. It gives you guidelines as you move to the future in like every area of life. And it's something that we should at least think about. I'm not trying to put a guilt trip on you, and never would I say you need to go back. Start where you are and go, what commitments can I make today that I'm going to stay with, even if they make me uncomfortable, even if they turn out to be not the greatest deal that I might thought they were going to be? Will I ever say, my word is my bond? I'll stick with something. Because that's something that God cared more about than he cared about not having Gentiles in the promised land. And he made that really clear. I think, too, another thing that I pull out of this story is, you know, the whole idea, first of all, we're uncomfortable with the notion of being slaves. And so we look at that, and, oh, yeah, but they had to be slaves. You understand, Jesus told us that we are supposed to be slaves, that we are not those who are to puff out our chest and demand our rights. We are to be, you know, if you want to be great in his kingdom, you're to be a servant of all. These guys, they had the greatest job. They're serving God. How they got there doesn't matter. How we got where we are, it doesn't matter. But are we willing to serve, or do we think that it's our job to figure out everything that's to our advantage, to take advantage of other people? And is that the way we want to really live our lives? Then there's a whole other aspect here about God's will. If you want to understand God's will really simply, you can buy into Reformed theology that says basically God had a plan, he knew exactly what was going to happen, and he made it happen, it happened exactly what it was supposed to be. Well, then how do you make sense of this story, and how do you make sense of most of our lives? The fact is, God's will, God is so in control that he isn't insecure, and he is able to say, you have a choice. So he goes, God isn't willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But I want everybody to be saved, but you can make a choice, and you can live with that choice. And then that choice becomes my will. It's an amazing, God's will is even more amazing than a simplistic, deterministic idea of the will of God. It's like his will was for them to not do this until they made the commitment, and now his will is different. Don't look backward in your life. Don't think, well, I never should have. One day at a time, starts now. What are you committed to right now? Start with that. Go with that. Is God's will is for you to have integrity and for me to have integrity. God's will is for us to keep our promises, to keep our word, even if sometimes, I mean, there have been times as a pastor, sometimes people will ask me to go speak somewhere, and I love speaking here. I don't really care about speaking anywhere else, whether big, huge places or small ones. It's like, no, this is where I want to be. But sometimes, you know, I'll go, sure, y'all, for you, I'll do it. I don't usually do it, but I'll do it for you. And then I'm like, why did I say that? And yet, I'm not going to then go, you know what, I gave it a second thought. I said I would do it, but now I'm not going to. No, I tell myself, and there are times when there's one place where I've been asked to speak several times where it's like it's a long drive, it's late at night, I can't hardly see the road as I'm coming home. And the whole time I'm going, this is the price I'm paying for making this decision. But I kept my word. I did what I said I was going to do. And I think for all of us, we're best if we understand the will of God in the context of he cares who you are right now. So will you today live up to commitments that you have made? Will you follow through on that? Don't go back and go, but we shouldn't have done that, and well, we were tricked, and there's a escape clause here, and there's a, no. Move forward. Life is too short to not move forward, and always realize I'm not defined by, you know, what somebody else does, or I'm ultimately, it's my choice. I decide today, am I a person of integrity or am I not? It's that simple. How do I keep commitments that I have made? And it's something that we should all think about. I think too, as Ann and I were talking over this passage, she was mentioning the Gibeonites kind of remind me of that guy that Jesus, the unjust steward that Jesus talked about in a parable where he said, there's this guy and he's like a lazy bum of a worker. He's just, and he hears that he's going to get fired. And so he starts going to all the customers and discounting their receivables, going, here, just I'll give you, pay me now and you can just pay 80% or whatever. And he did that not because he just thought, I know I'm fired, but I'm making friends with people so that after I'm fired, some of them may feel like they owe me. And it's so weird that Jesus would use someone like that as an example, but Jesus ends up with the story and says, a lot of times, the people of this world are more wise than the children of God. Sometimes the integrity of an unrighteous person tells you something. That in the case of that steward, at least he was thinking ahead. At least he was making preparations. Are we? What are we doing for our future? What are we doing for the future of those we love? How much does our word truly matter to us? And, you know, that to me, like this, when I think of the Gibeonites, just like when I think of that unjust steward, it reminds me, I have a pretty simple job, really. What am I committed to right now? Now, yes, there are other opportunities, and I may make future commitments. I want to think about them a little better as a result of some of those that I've made that didn't work out so well, but I'm going to keep my word, I'm going to keep that integrity, and I'm going to believe that somehow, even those things that were ill-conceived can turn into service for the Lord, something that I'm willing to do for him. So let's pray. Lord, thank you for giving us this story. Could have easily been left out. Certainly, the Jews would have liked to forget this part of their history. But you put it in here for a reason. And we're in this chapter today for a reason. Lord, may you teach all of us to check with you on everything. But whether we do or not, teach us to be people of integrity, that what you want us to do is to follow through on commitments that we've made. Help us not to be those flaky people that just bounce around from thing to thing and are always looking for an out, and you can always buy stuff and return it later. And Lord, teach us to be people who have integrity. And we thank you for this example. Lord, if there is anyone here or listening today who has never really even come into a relationship with you or commitment to you, help them to know that they're in a perfect spot right now. Whatever else they've done, whatever, however they've messed up their life, whatever successes they've enjoyed, it doesn't define their future. Help them to know they can come to you today and start fresh, and that you will honor everything that's on their plate, and that you'll lead and guide them and bless them as a result of them following you, even as the Gibeonites chose to do. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.